building a path for the peace paradigm. King and Gandhi, many more, have discovered something core. Now we're building a path for the peace paradigm. Every challenge is another highway sign.
Welcome, friends, to another episode of Peace Paradigm Radio. I'm your host, Stephanie Van Hook, and I'm here in the studio with my co-host and news anchor, Michael Nagler. And today is Friday, June 24th, 2016, and we're here to analyze all of the nonviolence that is happening in the world and to give people a better understanding of this great power that Gandhi was able to scientifically develop. And as our theme song from Lloyd Ferris says, many others as well have continued this work. And most excitingly, at this time, after seeing what's happening in the United States government, we're seeing leaders using nonviolence, quote, from above. So we want to talk about that a lot on our show today. So, Michael, why don't you get us started? What's so exciting about what John Lewis did, and who is he?
Oh, so many things about it are exciting, Stephanie. John Lewis was a major player in the civil rights movement, was very close to Martin Luther King, and became a congressperson, and was at various times the head of the Progressive Caucus in Congress, and has actually started a nonviolence education effort that I hope we can tell more about at one point. But what's happened now is that in response to the Orlando shooting, the worst mass shooting in American history, four bipartisan bills was submitted to Congress, and Senate refused even to consider them. Mm-hmm. At this point, John Lewis decided it was time for nonviolence, and specifically for Satyagraha. Maybe you can tell us a little bit more about the stages in a little while. But he actually said, I want my colleagues to join me down here on the floor of the House of Representatives, and they staged a sit-in. Mm-hmm. And it went on for 25 hours. They gave very good talks. Cory Booker, which just brought tears to my eyes, and John Lewis himself spoke very passionately, as we're about to hear. And then the thing was more or less mooted by House Speaker Paul Ryan, who pretty much called the plug, decided that the House was no longer in session. There were other very interesting elements to it. For example, Speaker Ryan did not want any film coverage, did not want any filming. Mm-hmm. But, of course, people have their little devices today, and there's Periscope, and CNN picked it up.
Yeah.
So it was actually broadcast live. It reminded us of an episode with a friend of ours, Abulzine Abulesh, who his house was hit by an Israeli tank shell during the Gaza siege. Three of his children, or two of his offspring and a niece, were killed or badly maimed. And it just so happened that he was on television, in Israeli television, when that happened. And the station manager said, shut it down, shut it down. But the newscaster, risking his career, left it on so that everybody could hear the despair and the anxiety that was going on. Well, this is a very different kind of event. But again, it was a refusal to follow regulations. Mm-hmm. So it was, in that sense, civil disobedience. And I'd like to talk a little bit more about that in a bit. But it was the first time anything like this has happened in the history of American politics. And it was a direct feed from nonviolence in America, from what the civil rights movement accomplished. I remember talking to some friends yesterday saying John Lewis was leading a sit-in, and they said he knows how to do that.
That's right. Yes. And he was saying that nonviolence is the solution to gun violence. So it's also very exciting times to hear this word being used by somebody in the government, which is very important. Now, as after this happened, after they decided to stand up and leave, not giving up on the struggle, but giving up the space at that point, the way that the media covered what happened raises certain questions. How deeply does the media understand how nonviolence works? And so that's really what we want to get into on the show today. So let's hear this famous speech, very, very moving speech from John Lewis that we're able to play on the show. So I'm going to turn that on.
On occasion, Mr. Speaker, I have had what I call an executive session with myself. For months, even for years, through several sessions of Congress, I wondered what would bring this body to take action. What would finally make Congress do what is right, what is just, what the people of this country have been demanding, and what is long overdue? We have lost hundreds and thousands of innocent people to gun violence. Tiny little children, babies, students, and teachers, mothers and fathers, sisters and brothers, daughters and sons, friends and neighbors. And what has this body done? Mr. Speaker, nothing. Not one thing. We have turned a deaf ears. We have turned deaf ears to the blood of the innocent and the concern of our nation. We are blind to a crisis. Mr. Speaker, where is the heart of this body? Where is our soul? Where is our moral leadership? Where is our courage? Those who work on bipartisan solution are pushed aside. Those who pursue common sense improvement are beaten down. Reason is criticized. Obstruction is praised. Newtown, Grover, Charleston, Orlando. What is the tipping point? Are we blind? Can we see? How many more mothers, how many more fathers need to shed tears of grief before we do something? We were elected to lead, Mr. Speaker. We must be headlights and not taillights. We cannot continue to stick our heads in the sand and ignore the reality of mass gun violence in our nation. Deadly mass shootings are becoming more and more frequent. Mr. Speaker, this is a fight. It is not an opinion. We must remove the blinders. The time for silence and patience is long gone. We are calling on the leadership of the House to bring common sense gun control legislation to the House floor. Give us a vote. Let us vote. We came here to do our job. We came here to work. The American people demand an action. Do we have the courage? Do we have raw courage to make at least a down payment on ending gun violence in America? We can no longer wait. We can no longer be patient. So today we come to the well of the House to dramatize the need for action. Not next month. Not next year, but now, today. Sometimes you have to do something out of the ordinary. Sometimes you have to make a way out of no way. We have been too quiet for too long. There comes a time when you have to say something, when you have to make a little noise.
Yes. That's right.
When you have to move your feet. This is the time. Now is the time to get in the way. Yes. The time to act is now. We will be silent no more. The time for silence is over. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
So that was John Lewis's speech before his other members of government to talk about nonviolence as a response to gun violence in this country. And if we hear the sentiment behind that, how can you hear not this a sense of anger in what he's saying, and yet anger is such a powerful tool for nonviolent action, because you don't have the sense that how he's going to use his anger is going to be in a way that's going to harm others, but you can see him harnessing that anger from the depths in order to do something that really matters. Michael.
Right on, Stephanie. You remember our famous quote from Martin Luther King, and I kept hearing echoes of Martin Luther King and Mario Savio, I might say, you know, throw yourself on the wheels of the machine. Because as King said, we did not arouse outbursts of anger. We harnessed anger under discipline for maximum effect. And I agree with you. That is the feeling that we get, precisely because he did not direct his anger towards the deprecation of persons. Mm-hmm. He challenged his colleagues, but it was what we call righteous indignation, and it looked like it is indeed being harnessed to get some action. Now, the thought I have in the back of my mind is a famous quote, LBJ talking to Martin Luther King when King had introduced his need for voter rights legislation. LBJ said to him, "That's a great idea. Now go out and make me do it." Mm-hmm. In other words, to carry the right kind of legislation through Congress, we are going to have to organize and protest out here in the streets and the homes of America. And at the end of our discussion, I want to make sure we get back around to that. What can we do as individuals?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But Stephanie, you mentioned before something about the timing here in the sense of how the conflict is escalating. Would you talk about that stage two question, as we like to refer to it?
Sure. So for those of you just tuning in, you're listening to Peace Paradigm Radio, and we're analyzing a bit of the sit-in that took place in Congress, and we just listened to John Lewis's speech. And number one myth about nonviolence that we'd like to debunk is that nonviolence, in order to be nonviolent, you can't be angry. That's just simply not true. Anger is fuel for transformative change in our world, but you really need to have something to put it into that can channel it in a way that is helpful for everybody. So here we have somebody demonstrating. If you have a class in peace studies, or if you want to learn about how that works, I'd say listen to John Lewis's speech, because he speaks for a lot of people. And so Michael asked me to analyze a bit the stages of the escalation curve that he actually came up with in Search for a Nonviolent Future, is where you can find it, page 108, for those who follow our work. The escalation curve in nonviolence suggests that as dehumanization rises, our nonviolence also has to escalate. And we break this chart, this sense of conflict escalation, nonviolent conflict escalation, into three parts. The first is conflict resolution, where people are still listening to you. And then that's the point where you lighting candles and in writing letters and signing petitions, because your voice is being listened to at that point. Even if it takes a little bit of work, you don't feel necessarily respected in those conversations. There could be some insults there could be some hard feelings, but there's you're still in a conversation, and that's still happening. You're talking and you're seeing each other as human beings, but with very opposing points of view. And there's something going to be done, and action will be taken. Now, you know that works when you get somewhere in that stage, but there's also signals when that doesn't work. And when it's being signaled that you're not being listened to, that you feel very strongly about the position that you're taking, you feel that you're standing on the side of justice, and you've been ignored, people aren't meeting with you, people are casting aside legislation saying that you worked on in a bipartisan way that represents the majority of what Americans feel, for example, then you know that that's the time to stop passing around the petitions or keep them going, but not to end with just that. And that's when we offer satyagraha. Satyagraha is a term that Gandhi coined in South Africa, and it highlights the essence of the struggle, meaning grasping to truth, meaning willingness to make a higher sacrifice. So it's not just at this point, I'm willing to put my name on a paper, but I'm willing to put my body in the way. And sometimes, now this is not the third stage of escalation, which is where you're willing to put your body in the way and to take on even death if that's what happens. That's stage three. That's where you go on long fasts at the right time. That's when you use, direct intervention kinds of tools and nonviolence. But what is important, if anybody listening to this show can take out of it, is that nonviolence is a strategic, it requires strategic thinking. And as that after Orlando and people are passing around petitions and decisions are still being made to ignore the voices of those who are putting out their opinions that they'd like to see something change, when that's being ignored, then that's when we know we have to escalate our tactics. So it's very heartening to see that a congressperson decided then to use nonviolence as a form of raising the bar, of raising the stake and saying, we're in a stage two conflict right now where voices are not being listened to and we're not going to keep doing the same thing. As he said, we have to do something out of the ordinary. Michael.
Stephanie, I'd like to just illustrate in a stage three for a bit how something like that can work. I ran across an interesting example of this recently in 1910, I believe it was. Gandhi was on a commission to England, and he spoke with Lord Amptill, who was sympathetic. And he had with him someone who represented a wealthier and more numerous section of the Indian community in South Africa. This person pointed out, we will accept your compromises because we are the more numerous and the wealthier party. And Gandhi said, we know that you are right, that you are more numerous, you are more wealthy, but my satyagrahis and I are resolute unto death. So that willingness to lay down one's life if necessary, but you try, of course, to head that off, but if necessary, that willingness to lay down your life has an extraordinary power. Now, no one has quite come to that point yet, but after all is said and done, this is an issue of life and death. People are being gunned down. So it is definitely important enough. And I could imagine that if we don't get a response to satyagraha, which was so startlingly and dramatically led off by Congressman Lewis and his colleagues, Nancy Pelosi, and many others, that it may come to that where people have to say, we will not put up with this anymore. There was an episode with the West Wing, which has been being played because it's so pertinent here. A gun control advocate points out, he names off about 10 or 12 countries which, put together, have the same population of the United States. And he says, and this is a statistical fact, as Congressman Lewis said, this is not opinion, this is a fact. In those 12 or so countries, there were 132 gun deaths last year. In the United States of America, there were 32,000. Why? It's not because of our genes. it's because of the absence of gun legislation. I'm going to go a step further and say that it's also because of our gun culture, the mystique of guns. And to give an example of that, James Gilligan, psychiatrist, Dr. James Gilligan, studied serial killers for quite a while, put in 25 years of research, and came to the conclusion that the feeling that one has lacking dignity is the main cause and predictor of violent crime. And he quotes one convict as saying, "I never got so much respect as when I shoved a gun in that dude's face." So we're going to come back to that and think about how to address that. But one interesting question that's been raised is that former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said, "We're going to be here till hell freezes over." Now, they were really only there for 25 hours, and that raises an awkward question in nonviolence, that you shouldn't make threats that you cannot follow through on.
Right.
Now, I maintain that she didn't mean we're going to be sitting here on the floor until hell freezes over, but rather we're not going to go away. We're not going to stop our efforts. And I bet that they are caucusing right now to figure out how to carry this further.
Which brings us to myth number two in this show, which is that there's a sense that nonviolence always has to come from the grassroots. And this is showing that we have people, we have members of Congress, members of a government who are using nonviolence. So we're learning that nonviolence can work from any direction, from quote unquote above in the social hierarchy in terms of government, or from the grassroots. And ideally is when they're working together. Yeah.
I am so glad you raised that, Stephanie, because this is quite an issue for me. You know, I used to talk about an institution called Third Party Nonviolent Intervention. That name was changed to Unarmed Civilian Peacekeeping. And I like to talk about nonviolence. Other people talk about civil resistance. And I've been arguing with them as individuals and in writing and so forth, that they're kind of missing the point that it isn't who's doing it, but what they're doing that we should be paying attention to. So I'm actually preparing a juicy email as we speak now, which I'm going to mail off to some of my colleagues and say, are you going to call this civil resistance if Congress people are offering it? Mm. It's an interesting point.
And you have some examples of when nonviolence has been used, quote unquote, from above. Would you like to share the story of Emperor Ashoka, for example?
Yes, thank you, Steph. This is historical examples of whole governments that were based on nonviolent principles. The Emperor Ashoka lived in the 3rd century of our era. He was a Maurya. He had inherited a large kingdom from his grandfather. He carried out a war of conquest against a neighboring people called the Kalingas. He, quote, won, unquote, he defeated them in battle. But then he went out into the battlefield and he heard the cries of the wounded, the lamentations of the widows, kind of the thing that Congressman Lewis was just talking about. And he did have heart. He was so struck that he decided to abandon war forever at that moment. And so he managed, interestingly enough, to greatly expand his kingdom. And
brings us into another myth, which I'll get to, but please finish.
Yeah, I bet I know the one that's coming, and I'm very glad. But yeah, he was extremely successful and expanded his kingdom, and never from that point forward, he ruled for about another 25, 30 years. He never carried out warfare as an act of conquest. He has set up hospitals for animals. He was one of the people who was responsible for the transmission of Buddhism to many South Asian countries, Sri Lanka, among others. But there's another example that's a lot closer to home, and that's called the Holy Experiment. That took place in what is now Pennsylvania. It turns out that William Penn was a follower of George Fox, the founder of what we today call Quakerism. In fact, at one point, Penn, whose father was an admiral, said to George Fox, "Should I still be carrying my sword?" Fox made a very interesting response to him. He said, "Sir, carry thy sword as long as thou canst." In other words, if you don't have that feeling of moral repugnance and you're leaning on that weapon for a feeling of security, it would be wrong to put it down. But of course, he was hoping that he would grow quickly to a state where he would not be relying on weapons for security. And that's what happened in the Holy Experiment that went on for 70 years and was never overwhelmed by outside forces.
Oh, thank you, Michael. There's a lot that we can go into on any of these stories. The one thing I wanted to point out that's demonstrated by Emperor Ashoka, for example, as nonviolence from above, from the government, is that the myth is that we hold culturally, seems, is that human beings don't change. We're born a certain way, and there's good guys and there's bad guys. And if you're a bad guy, you're always going to be a bad guy making bad decisions. And we have to use humiliation and shame and all of these and use, basically, as Vinoba Bhave would say, break our head against the walls of your spirit instead of going in right through the heart, that we can insult you into changing. And what the story of Emperor Ashoka really shows us is that human beings do change. And when they do see something bigger than themselves, that they can have a moment, une prise de conscience, as you'd say in French, mm-hmm. sort of an awakening of your consciousness,
yeah.
To change you, to change your entire worldview. And then you can also start creating programs based on that change of consciousness. And if we had a more flexible view of the human being's ability to change, a lot could get done with nonviolent energy, I'd say.
Right. Oh, and it's precisely the job of a nonviolent person, of a satyagrahi, to awaken the opponent. Now, you can't always necessarily wait for that to happen. Sometimes you have to act for the protection of others, and this may be one of them. But it, as a satyagrahi, you never give up that faith that your opponent can be reached, and you never stop trying to reach him or her in any way that's possible. That's why we sometimes take on suffering in nonviolence.
You're listening to Peace Paradigm Radio. I'm your host, Stephanie Van Hook, and I'm here in the studio with my co-host and news anchor, Michael Negler. Today, we have been talking about Representative John Lewis and the sit-in that he helped to organize in the Congress, an activist, a very famous activist from the civil rights movement who has continued his work for civil rights throughout his long career, has brought something to the floor of Congress that really hasn't been seen in this number before. We have over 100 senators with him, on the congressmen with him on the floor. That's super important to see that nonviolence can happen from any direction. It can happen from government officials. And so on the show today, we're analyzing what happened because the media is not doing a super job of helping us to understand how nonviolence works. Really, what I saw, for example, in the, I believe it was the Washington Post, that people are saying in February, Lewis called Ryan sincere and very smart and someone who President Obama and Democrats can do business with. And people are saying, before the Democratic House takeover, Ryan and Lewis had a good relationship, so forth. Believing, what's the myth behind that? That's suggesting that, well, if you oppose somebody or you don't agree with them, then all of a sudden you're not friends anymore. You can't agree on anything ever again, and your friendship is broken. Michael, do you want to talk about the myth behind that, that the way the media is portraying that and what nonviolence is really about?
Yeah, this it really is a pity that they're not getting it. You know, the Quakers always used to say there is that of God in every man. And Gandhi was famous for saying that he said, this is a direct quote, "I hate from the bottom of my soul the system of government that the British have set up in India, but I refuse to hate any domineering Englishman, just as I refuse to hate any domineering Hindu. And it is quite a remarkable lesson from that freedom struggle in India, the way that England and India are now friends, better friends than England is with the European Union at this point. And an interesting contrast that comes up here is that the relationship between France and Algeria was nowhere near this cordial, because the Algerian uprising, which also gained independence, did so through violence. It cost much more in terms of blood and treasure, and the two countries did not end up with a close, friendly relationship, and there was very little democracy to show for it at the end. So the critical thing for a nonviolent person to be able to do is to see, as you were saying before, Stephanie, see the core potential of that human being to change, and above all, see the difference between the person and his or her action, his or her attitude.
And their role.
And their role in any kind of abusive system. So that a nonviolent person will tend not to use labels like racist, torturer, or what have you, because he or she is always trying to remain aware of the person underneath that role and that attitude.
Mm-hmm. I think it's we're going to try to go deeper into the cause of gun violence in America throughout this conversation. And I think part of it has to do with the misunderstanding of nonviolence. Because the if we understood nonviolence better and how it worked, then people would understand that it is much more effective, even statistically proved more effective than violence when it's used. And the media can either help us or hinder us in this process. But right away, as we're seeing the CNN and the Washington Post and so forth saying that, this means that Ryan and Lewis are no longer friends because there's a disagreement and because he's being called out or being opposed. That's setting up a worldview of us against them, of the good guys and bad guys. So they're trying to show John Lewis as the good guy. Yeah. And that suggesting that then by putting himself in the position of the good guy that he's become that Ryan has become the bad guy. Yeah. So let's get past that. Let's get past these labels. Yeah. And just to review some of the other myths that have come up with the media so far and understanding what happened, the suggestion that you can be angry and you can use your anger in nonviolence, that's a truth. To think that you can't be angry and nonviolent at the same time, that's a myth. That's something that is keeping us from using nonviolence more effectively. If we say, oh, you're an angry person, and then we don't give people an outlet, that really can cause a lot of frustration and then even erupt into personal violence or violence against others. And the other myth is that nonviolence can't come from above. It only has to come from the grassroots every time. And we're, speaking truth to power, and but we're all in it together, and nonviolence can happen in any direction. This is being demonstrated by what the sit-in was able to accomplish. The third is that we can change as human beings, and everybody has the potential. Even if you're on the wrong side, you can still change and to be able to, for society to be able to welcome people who have expressed the humility of saying that they're wrong, actually then encourages more people to do the same instead of shaming people as they come out and say, you know, I did make a decision, or triumphing over them, saying that's what you get. Who's going to want to move over and shift their opinion if that's the kind of culture that we're creating for them? So people can change, and we need to accommodate that. That's another tool in nonviolence. And finally, we can disagree without hating each other, because hatred's a different kind of energy. Is it Rumi that there's love in my heart, so there is no room for anything else?
That was Rabia, actually.
I was getting
Rabia
there.
Rabia Basra, but she was a Sufi.
Sufi, getting there. The next thing I want to talk about is very interesting, and I haven't seen much analysis of how this worked, but I think for nonviolence news, we need to look at this. But they left after the 25, 26 hours, and John Lewis said, this was a victory. after we have people like Nancy Pelosi saying, we're not going to leave until, till that place, wherever that belongs, freezes over. So what? How did they win? Can you talk to us about work versus work, Michael, and the Tiananmen blunder?
Yes, I certainly can. The Tiananmen blunder, which is really how I got launched into this lifelong dedication to nonviolence. The students in Tiananmen Square had made their point by their ability to occupy the square, and it was then time for them to leave. Now, today we have actual terms for this. They were practicing collective rather than dispersive configurations. When you're all collected in one place, first of all, you're vulnerable. Second of all, and even more importantly, I think, the square was only a symbol, just as actually partly what the Congress people did was symbolic, but partly it was real because they are up there in the decision-making body and they're insisting on some decision being made. So now if you look at what happened, for example, in the Egyptian uprising a few years ago, when the first impulse was just get collected in Tahrir Square, as many as possible, they found themselves extremely vulnerable. And then they hit upon the idea of collecting in little nodes, in little neighborhoods, in little side streets. Then when they were aware of their power, to go into Tahrir. So I don't see, even if they had done it by choice rather than the fact that Speaker Ryan closed the place down and they had no choice, even if they had done it by choice, I think it was the right move. They had made their point. They had left. It was time to leave and then collect your forces. You have demonstrated your commitment. Now let's go out and do something constructive to build that commitment into action.
And it's as you were saying that, it just occurred to me as well, if I were friends with John Lewis personally as Paul Ryan is, and we're not going to let the media tell us differently, let's think strategically about what happened as well, in nonviolence. If you don't have an opposition force in that kind of dialectic that where somebody to oppose you, to turn off the cameras, then it weakens your message in a way. It can weaken your message in a way. In a sense, in the more cosmic view, they're really working together for truth, because by shutting off the cameras, by trying not to draw attention to it, it was actually doing what is called a paradox of repression. It was strengthening what was happening, and perhaps deep down in his heart, he knew that he couldn't stop himself from doing these things because this is how he had to play it out. But by creating a bit of opposition to what was happening, it helped to magnify the message in a way that it couldn't have before.
That's so correct. If you remember, even in the Attenborough's Gandhi film, when Gandhi is on the salt march and the American journalist playing the role of Webb Miller asks him, what will you do if they ignore you? He said, it is the responsibility of a satyagrahi to provoke a response.
Yeah.
So you're absolutely right that Speaker Ryan was inadvertently perhaps playing his role and in the dialectic. And also by wanting there to be no exposure, he put himself in a much weaker position.
That's right. Yep. And so that brings up, we just reviewed two more myths that have come up, is that nonviolence doesn't have to, you don't have to stay in the same place in order to prove that you're going to get what you want eventually in a struggle. You don't have to say, you're allowed to move, you're allowed to be flexible, and maybe you're occupying a space and then you leave that space. And it makes people wonder, well, what's going to come next? And it throws people off balance in a way, so that if they're not, it creates a strategic understanding of something else that can come, that something else can happen. If you stick to one tactic and one technique, not likely to be successful. So not clinging to public spaces, that's a myth surrounding nonviolence, that you have to cling to the space that you just held or that thing. And Gandhi and King and Lewis are showing that, you know, actually you can cling to a space and then let go, because you have to understand that the next thing is that nonviolence requires strategy. And somebody that was on the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and so forth knows a little bit about what strategy is, I'm sure. And so it's not something that's necessarily being let known on the surface exactly, but there's a strong sense of a current underneath that something's happening and we're making decisions based on a bigger plan.
Yep. Okay. This, what you're leading up to here, work versus work, is one of the biggest omissions, one of the biggest absences in the understanding of the general public and the media, that you can appear to not get what you want in the short term on the surface and yet have made your impact. Mm-hmm. In fact, recently on this program, I contrasted these two statements that one of the retired generals of Shin Bet, the Israeli Security Service, said of their whole approach, "We are winning every battle and losing the war." Mm-hmm. And I contrasted that with one of the biographers of Mahatma Gandhi, who said, "You have to realize, nonviolence is the kind of thing where you can lose every battle and go on to win the war."
Mm-hmm. That was B.R. Nanda.
B.R. Nanda, that's right. The late B.R. Nanda. And so I think that those who are probably saying that, Ryan saved the situation and they accomplished nothing, and that they are completely wrong, that they have actually started something tremendous. Of course, it remains to be seen whether they will, as you say, strategically continue it. You know, I'd like to get into the question of whether this was civil disobedience. It's very interesting. As I understand it anyway, there are four criteria for civil disobedience. And this recent sit-in did spectacularly well on the first three, and we're not sure what's going to happen with the fourth.
Okay. What are the criteria?
Okay, here we go. So first of all, it should not be a frivolous cause. And of course, this is a matter of life and death, which is why we suggested things might have to go to stage three to resolve it. Mm-hmm. So gun violence in America, if you want to look at it in the biggest picture, I think what we're actually doing is giving democracy a bad name. We're doing to democracy what Russia did to communism, quite frankly. Mm-hmm. But in any case, this is definitely not a frivolous issue. It's a serious cause. The second point is the second criterion, that other means of persuasion have been exhausted. And boy, was John Lewis eloquent on that point. They have argued and argued. They have showed you the statistics. They can quote you the statistics that show, relevant to a point you raised earlier, Stephanie, that having a handgun doesn't actually make you safer. We could go into that maybe at some point.
Oh, it doesn't?
No, actually. Oh, okay. Sorry to disillusion you. No, it doesn't. So a third point, which often is where wannabe civil disobedient efforts fall down on this criterion, and I'll again quote Gandhi here. He said, "Disobedience, in order to be nonviolent, must be civil." And he did not mean that it has to come from civil society, mm-hmm. as we were saying before. What it meant is that the tone and the methods are civil. And I think you could hear, despite the aroused anger that was in John Lewis's voice, he never resorted to deprecation the way certain presidential candidates are wont to do nowadays. Mm. So just to throw in a contrasting example, back in the 1980s, there was an attempt in California. And I might point out, incidentally, that at this very time when this is going on in Congress and they can't pass even the most minimal gun control, California has just put gun control on the ballot. So it's going to be there for all of us in November. Anyway, back in the 80s, the state wanted assault weapon owners to register. Okay, so we're talking about exactly the kind of weapons that were used in Orlando. And they figured that there were about 5,000 or 6,000 folks who had assault rifles at that time. and it was a flop. Very few people actually registered their weapons. And with one commentator, which almost caused me, because I was listening in my car radio at that time. I don't do that anymore, but I almost went off the road. One commentator said, this is an act of massive civil disobedience. Mm. Well, of course, it was nothing of the kind. It was a complete failure by that third criterion that the tone and the methods have to be civil, have to be polite. Now, the fourth criterion, which we don't know yet whether it's going to be met, is this is perhaps the core principle in civil disobedience, that while you are disobeying a regulation, you are willing to pay the penalty. So this shows, in other words, that you are not opposed to the principle of law, you are not breaking the social contract, but you are purifying the law by disobeying a wrong part of it. So I haven't heard about any sanctions being imposed on those Congress people, the representatives who did this sit-in. If there is such a sanction, I hope that they will take it with pride, because that will mean that this is a true civil disobedience action.
Okay. And when you say true, can you explain more? Because we have seen acts of civil disobedience that don't necessarily follow these guidelines. So are you saying that this is, in your view, what would make, in your research, makes civil disobedience more effective, more nonviolent, more humanizing? Can you say something about this?
Yeah, definitely. The fact that, is, for example, if you say, I'm not going to obey your stupid law because you're in the wrong and I want to gain power over you, then that's the opposite of rehumanization. Mm-hmm. It's the opposite of reconciliation, because mm-hmm. you're saying, as you were saying before, so you're bad guys and there's nothing that can be done about it. It's also very poor form if you disobey a law for your own benefit. And the classic example of this is war tax refusal. Mm-hmm. People who don't pay their war taxes have a couple of options that they need to follow. One is, I'm just not going to give the government the money, and then you go out and spend it on yourself. Mm-hmm. Then it does not become a civil disobedience. But if you withhold that money from the government and put it into a fund, say, or spend it in some other way mm-hmm. that helps the anti-war struggle, mm-hmm. something like that, then you're not just doing it for your own personal benefit. And so then it does count as a civil disobedient action.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That helped. That helps, Michael. Thank you. For those of you just tuning in, this is Peace Paradigm Radio, and we're analyzing the nonviolence and the nonviolent sit-in that took place in Congress with Representative Lewis. And I'm going to review a bit of the myths that we've covered so far, because the important thing is that we're getting to the point of what causes gun violence in America. And what we're getting to is the sense of a culture of insecurity. And if we can address that culture, we'd be on the way to renouncing guns voluntarily and having legislation be common sense legislation, as John Lewis called it, being seen as what it is, which is common sense. But I want you to listen to the myths, because the other thing is that part of the reason that we have gun violence is because the world doesn't understand nonviolence as deeply as it should. And nonviolence can then, when we understand it, offer that deep security. So let's look at these myths. So nonviolence doesn't mean that you can't be angry. Nonviolence comes from anger transformed and put into channels that are extremely constructive and helpful to everybody. So if we had a culture where anger could be channeled into useful, constructive means, we'd have a state of better security. There's a myth that nonviolence can't come from above. It can't come from the government. So then it puts us in an us and us versus them, opposition, good guys, bad guys, corrupt, non-corrupt, purists, so forth. But nonviolence can come from any angle. And the other sense is that you can't change as a human being. And that is a total, that's just not true. Human beings can change, and people can be persuaded nonviolently to change their view on the world. And it can be a very deep understanding that changes. So by shifting our view of human beings as something having a rigid personality that doesn't change, to understanding that we do change and we are reasonable and we can be worked with to see something that is higher and better, would make the culture safer and more secure for people. The sense of in nonviolence, you have to be triumphalist, that you can't, if you didn't get what you wanted, then it didn't work. The truth is that you work a little bit, you might not get what you want at first, and then you come at it in a different way. And so that just because one tactic or one technique didn't get you what you wanted immediately does not mean that the nonviolence didn't work. Understanding that something's happening beneath the surface then is a very important lesson for those who are looking for another way out of gun violence and a deeper security. The sense that we can disagree and be on opposing sides of an issue without hating each other, because there's not room for hatred in our hearts, this would open up, would have people talking more, having more communication and helping to lower the dehumanization in our culture, because we think that even if we disagree, we can still work it out. So this is, again, changing our image of the human being. But then also in terms of nonviolent tactics and strategies, that nonviolence isn't about just holding on to specific spaces. You can hold on to a space for a little bit as a tactic, then let it go, and then move into another area and do something else, doing the unexpected. Nonviolence requires creative thinking because it is creative energy. And then I want to, now, those are the, that's, if those aren't hard to accept for anybody, that's fine. But I'm going to now say something that might upset some of our listeners, which is that the last myth that I want to bring up right before we end our show is that what we're seeing with John Lewis coming out against gun violence and staging a sit-in, and this is my hypothesis, is that people actually want a leader. And there's a myth in nonviolent circles that the only way is to have a leaderless, you know, revolution, nobody at the top, nobody leading the way, because look what happened to leaders, and leaders are corrupt and so forth. But in reality, what we're seeing with Bernie Sanders, with John Lewis, is that people understand the image of the human being that's coming at them from a leader who they feel very strongly about, and they're willing to rally behind somebody if they take up the cause. So I know that Erica Chenoweth, this political scientist in nonviolence, has pointed out that the best configuration is to have, you know, a mixture between the leaderful aspect and the charismatic leader. So we're seeing that happen, and I'm saying that might annoy some activists out there, because there is quite an ideology about nonviolence, as there's no leaders ever, and we can get past that. Michael.
It didn't annoy me.
Okay.
I'm with you.
Okay. Do you have any thoughts to wrap up?
I do. And this may be our most important contribution, that nobody seems to be addressing the needs, the actual needs of gun enthusiasts, whether they're lobbyists or just owners. What are they after? What do they want with that gun? Now, you mentioned a sense of security. I mentioned earlier a sense of respect. I'm going to add one thing here that may be the most important of all. They feel helpless. And if you remember what President G.W. Bush said right after 9/11, he said to the American people, take the kids to Disneyland. In other words, you are helpless. There's nothing that you can do for your own security. If we were somehow able to show people that they have tremendous agency, the gun problem would disappear.
Thank you very much. That's Michael Nagler, my co-host here on Peace Paradigm Radio. Until the next time, everybody, take care of one another. And a big thank you to our mother station, KWMR, all our listeners, supporters, and the staff at the Meta Center for Nonviolence. Thanks a lot. Bye.